Log Talk Radio.
I am doing just peachy. In fact, what's actually happening right now is I'm stalling. I'm stalling because I'm trying to get my fucking videos in order, and my videos today are endless. I have an infinite number of videos for you. So it's kind of important I have them in order today, because if I don't, I will be scrambling during the live show, and nobody wants that. I certainly don't want that. You don't want that. A guy named Steve listening in Arkansas does not want that. By the way, even before we start here, and this is actually super important, shout out to everybody in Louisiana, man. What's going on there is unbelievable. I looked at an article yesterday. I tweeted it out. You have caskets. So apparently they don't, when they bury people, they don't put them underground in Louisiana because the swamp just kind of spits them right back out. And apparently, because of the intense flooding that's happening now, like a lot of the you'll just see a casket floating down the middle of the street. It's some crazy shit. They say it's the worst natural disaster in the United States since Hurricane Katrina. So seriously, shout out to everybody there. And in California, again, it's the climate, man. Climate change is happening. It's happening right in front of our eyes. You have an increase in extreme weather events. This is why eventually people stop calling it global warming and turn it to climate change, is because it's not just that it gets hotter, which it does, but it's also that you have an increase in extreme weather events. So, for example, winter rolls around, there's going to be even more intense blizzards, for example. That's not going to be disproven climate change. It's further evidence of climate change. And, you know, this is something you can track the patterns all along, and it's absolutely devastating. So, I got a lot of great stuff for you guys today. I wasn't able to get to the Jill Stein town hall on CNN yesterday because they didn't post the videos fast enough. They didn't post the entire thing fast enough. But today, I'm going to get to it, and there's a lot here for you. So I got a whole bunch of stuff from Jill Stein's town hall. I have fantastic news here on the criminal justice system and what's happening with private prisons. I got a heartwarming story. Well, I don't know how heartwarming it is, but the response is very human, I should say, from CNN, where an anchor has a real moment and talks about the devastation happening in Syria. We're going to discuss that a little bit. And later on in the show, hopefully we have time to discuss World Rohingya Day, which I'm sure many of you don't know what that is, and hopefully I can educate you on it. It's some insane oppression that's happening right now in Myanmar. And I've been trying to get to this story for 3 days now. I really have to get to it. The Salafi preacher who has some serious deep thoughts on emojis for us. Oh, man, is that cute. Okay, so let's get started here. And I'm going to do that with the big news on private prisons. I hope you have a champagne bottle ready because you're going to have to pop it, bitch, because we got good news. All right, let's do it. We have some fantastic news here on the issue of the criminal justice system. BBC explains the U.S. Justice Department will phase out privately owned prisons, citing safety concerns. Contracts with 13 private prisons will be reviewed and allowed to expire over the next 5 years. Quote, they do not save substantially on costs, and they do not maintain the same level of safety and security, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates said, explaining the decision.
The majority of U.S. prisoners are held in state-run prisons. On Wall Street, the stocks of private prison companies declined sharply after the news was announced. By Thursday afternoon, Corrections Corporation of America stock had plunged by nearly 50%. An inspector general's report released this month found that private prisons saw higher rates of violent incidents and rule infractions in comparison with government-run institutions. As of December, private prisons housed 22,660 federal inmates out of a total of nearly 200,000. And then they also say here there were 94,365 prisoners being held in private facilities overseen by states in the year 2011. So let's understand what this isn't. This isn't shutting down all private prisons in the United States of America. What it is basically shutting down over time, over a five-year period, they're going to let all the contracts expire, shutting down all the private prisons that are part of the federal system. So the states still have private prisons, depending on which state you're talking about, of course. But the federal government now is going to phase them out. And again, that means shutting down 13 different private prisons. And the numbers are there are 22,660 federal inmates in private prisons out of a total of 200,000. So now, soon, you're going to have all the 200,000 federal inmates in public prisons. So this is a gigantic step in the right direction. When I heard that the stocks were plummeting for private prison companies, here's what I thought. Good. Fuck them with a trillion dicks and a trillion dicks from hell. Fuck them. There's a huge problem, a systemic problem with private prisons. The incentive structure is beyond fucked up. I mean, you want to talk about a poor incentive structure. Oftentimes we talk about when you have private health insurance companies, because how do they make their money? Well, the way they make more profit and pad the bottom line is simply by denying as much care as possible. So you have an incentive problem where they're incentivized to deny care so that they can make more money. So this is why in some areas, obviously not in all areas, in some areas, you know, a private company that wants to make profit, the incentive is perfectly fine. If you're making video games, you know, or if you're making cars, why not have the profit motive there? There's really not as much of a perverse incentive structure. You need regulation, but it's not a perverse incentive. Well, when it comes to the health insurance industry, this is why virtually all other modern nations have a single-payer healthcare system. The government is the insurer. And also another area where it's perhaps even more obvious is you can't have for-profit prisons, you fucking jackass. Why? Because then the people who run those prisons, what are they going to want to do? They're going to want to lock up more people. Why are they going to want to lock up more people? Because that's how they make more money. So, for example, prison lobbyists go to politicians, and they lobby them, and they tell them, hey, here's some money. Why don't you make some more shit illegal? I'm not kidding about that. So they want to make more things illegal so they can lock more people up and they can make more money. One of the things that's been happening recently is undocumented immigrants. If you catch an undocumented immigrant committing a crime, it used to be the case, you know, back in the day, okay, you have a procedure and you're gonzo. you're not in the country anymore. So that's a way where you're overall saving resources, right? Because they committed a crime, so I have no sympathy in the sense that I'm not going to say you could stay here if you're an undocumented immigrant and then you commit a crime. If you're an undocumented immigrant and you come in here, that's a different conversation. But if you do it and you commit a crime, okay, I have no problem with you leaving, and I want you out. Well, now they're saying, no, no, an undocumented immigrant commits a crime, we're just going to hold undocumented immigrants in private prisons and keep them there because we can make money from that. I mean, think about that. And also, just the term private prison is very misleading because it's still taxpayers funding it. It's just now you have public money funding it when the institution says, hey, we are private, we have to abide by fewer rules that apply to the public prisons, and we have an actual profit margin and we can put the money in our pocket. And again, this is why you have a worse situation with safety, and this is why you have a situation where the guards aren't as well trained, and there's been stories of the food there being way worse quality because they're trying to cut corners and make more money. And, you know, there's been stories of rotten meat served to the inmates and whatnot. So there's a huge incentive problem. Three strikes laws, for example. You know where that comes from? That comes from private prisons lobbying the government, and this isn't at the federal level. I believe it's in California and maybe some other states as well, where they say, okay, why don't we make it so that if you commit three felonies, no matter how minor they may be, well, now it's life in prison. That, you know, that's not something that people would casually accept if it wasn't for the fact that you had lobbyists pushing for it because there's an ulterior motive. And the ulterior motive is we get to make more money if we lock up more people. And, of course, it got so bad in California specifically that after a while they were like, we have a prison overcrowding problem. We got to start releasing people, dude. We got to start. And they have. They've released a lot of nonviolent drug offenders, which is a good thing. So I cannot tell you how happy I am about this because it's a gigantic problem and nobody even really pays attention to it. The idea that now we lock up, citizens for lesser and lesser crimes and the only reason we're doing it is because there are people making money off it and so they're trying to get more people locked up. I mean, the United States, you want to talk about incarceration issues. Everybody already knows the United States incarcerates more people than any other country on the planet. Why would we do that? You know, Bernie Sanders said it during one of the debates. We lock up more people than tolerant China. I mean, that's crazy. We have more people in jail in the U.S. than Stalin did in his gulags at their height. That's absolutely mind-blowing. So getting rid of private prisons is a start, but you guys already know, and credit to Obama on this front and in this other area, he's been starting to release more and more nonviolent drug offenders. Release as many as you possibly can, man. I would even twist arms and try to get the ones at the state level to be released, even though he doesn't have power to pardon or commute their sentences. But I'd twist arms and say, okay, so you guys don't want to release your nonviolent drug offenders at the state level? Well, maybe I cut your funding. Whoops. Well, then they'll go, okay, no, okay, maybe we'll release some of them. Let's sit down and have a conversation. So this is great news. Everybody should be happy about it. And I hope the states take the next step. And they go, let's go further down this path, man. Let's go further down this path. Forget private prisons. They shouldn't exist in the first place. I mean, this is one of the main things that when you're making a list of government functions, this is, you know, in the top 5 or top 10 things that you can't have privatized because of the poor incentive structure. We should all acknowledge that, we should know that, and we should go back to a system where prisons and jails are there out of necessity. You put the worst of the worst in there, and no, you don't privatize it so people make money off of it and therefore want to lock up more people. Okay. Now, let's move on. Eric Bolling with his war on math. Can't wait to see this. Genius Fox News commentator Eric Bolling has some deep thoughts for us on the issue of presidential polls. Let's watch.
These polls, Dana, I'm honestly, we have to stop with these polls. They're insane with polls. You look at these, just look what's going on. You look at a Trump rally, and there's 12,000, 15,000, 10,000 people.
You cannot believe
it. And then you look at Hillary Clinton, and you have, I don't know, 1,500, 2,000, but that's
it's a real, that's a real disservice.
The poll 82 days out.
It's a real disservice to
whom?
His supporters to lie to them that that those polls don't matter. You cannot take 12,000 people at a rally that are your definite supporters. They are going to show up to campaign and then say the polls are wrong.
She has that opportunity.
But one person sitting at home still cancels out somebody
fair.
At a rally.
It's not fair.
Here's why polls really shouldn't matter or shouldn't ever matter. You pick up the phone and you say, who are you going to vote for? That person on the other end of the phone says, well, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
But
they're not out there voting.
But when the polls
are
good,
getting out
you say
in the street
opposite.
And going to a rally, those are people who get up off the couch and go hear something and go say something. That's why I think
you're saying they're
the
motivated?
Size of crowds is more indicative of following or even polling than actual people.
But I would say that a person sitting home getting up to vote cancels out the person there. It's the same value.
Remember, that's exactly what we said in 2012, when people that supported Romney were told that the polls are wrong, Romney is going to win, and then they were so mad and disappointed.
Yeah, they stopped watching because they thought we lied to them,
yeah.
and we deserved it.
Okay, that was cute. Let me tell you where Bowling is 100% wrong, embarrassingly wrong, and he should probably wear a sign on his chest that says shame or idiot. So there's one area where that's the case, obviously. I'm sure you guys can already point it out. But then there's one area where I think some people are being a little bit unfair to him, and I want to describe that. So here's where he's wrong when he says, quote, "We have to stop with these polls." And, quote, "Polls shouldn't ever matter." Oh, that is so stupid. Oh, that's on a whole nother level of stupid. Polls shouldn't ever matter. And we all know why he's saying it. He's saying it because his guy is down right now. His guy's Donald Trump, hates Hillary Clinton. And he's like, well, now they don't count. Oh, Jesus. Somebody should go back to the archives and look at what he said when Trump was actually up in the polls. Because it wasn't that long ago. You know, there were three, maybe four different times in this race where Trump was actually up. So I guarantee you there's got to be something out there of him citing poll numbers, whether it's attacking Obama when Obama had low poll numbers at one point or another. Like, see, nobody likes him. Polls, polls, polls. When they say what he doesn't like, polls, quote, polls shouldn't ever matter. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. So obviously that's where he's wrong. Here's where there's a grain of truth in what he's saying. There is indeed an enthusiasm gap. So, in other words, there's not nothing to the comment that Trump's rallies are bigger and the people are more passionate. No, there really is more enthusiasm, more passion for Donald Trump. It just so happens that a smaller percentage of the country is on his side and on his team and going to vote him and going to support for him. But the people who do support him are super enthusiastic about it. Now, Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, there's no denying, according to the polls right now, it's obvious, because the last 20 polls or more now have her up. She's up by about 7 points on average. So more people support Hillary Clinton. Make no mistake about it. The polls ain't lying, bitch. The polls are not lying. But it is true that a lot of the people who vote for Hillary are just like, yep, Hillary. Hillary Clinton. Whereas the Trump people are like, bah, Donald Trump, make America great again. Fuck the Mexicans and the Muslims. Yes! So, you know, some morons can misinterpret from this, oh, those people are really loud, really passionate, really aggressive, really enthusiastic, and there's a lot of them at the rally, therefore, see, that's proof that, you know, Donald Trump is actually up and polls are irrelevant. Now, I understand, guys, so every time we talk about polls, like, for a while, I was going after Nate Silver because I think Nate Silver was doing the wrong analysis and not paying attention to the data and the information in the polls. So every time I've maintained for a while that Trump was actually the favorite, and the race, and when he wasn't the favorite, the race was much closer than people gave it credit for. Why? Dude, the fucking poll showed that in the primary. I kept saying when only three states had voted, I said, it's almost a guarantee that Trump is going to be the nominee. It'd be a minor miracle if he didn't win. Only three primary states had voted. So I called that. This is when Nate Silver was writing fucking articles saying, you know, the polls show Trump winning, but in reality he's going to lose, or something to that effect. Like, polls show him up, but that doesn't matter. Like, you know, he was just over and over, never Trump, it's not going to be 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 Trump. I was saying all along, no, it's because of the polls. Because of the polls that I'm telling you that Trump is going to win, or overwhelmingly likely to win in the primary. Well, that's the case now. When you look at the polls now, it is what it is. Hillary's got an overwhelming chance. The day where Trump was up and the day was a closer race, that's not right now. Now, maybe the yo-yo effect will continue and Trump will make a comeback to one extent or another. But as of right now, if the election were today, landslide and a half, bitch. I mean, Hillary is destroying today. She's up in virtually every swing state. She's up in almost every national poll. So, in other words, my point is the polls matter every single step of the way, and the facts matter every single step of the way. But, yes, it is also true that one of the facts is there is an enthusiasm gap, and that goes in Trump's favor. So, you know, he has a smaller group of people supporting him, but they love him much more than the wider group of people who are supporting Hillary Clinton. Many of them are just saying, Hillary Clinton, whatever, I guess I'll go vote for her. So that's important to remember. And actually, it was also the case with Bernie Sanders. Now, I maintain, given more time, I think Bernie Sanders would have won. Bernie Sanders started out with very few people in the country knowing who he is. He's an 107-year-old Jewish, maybe atheist, democratic socialist who admits that. But he's super likable. And he started with, you know, very, very little support. And then over time, he went from nothing to 46% of the vote in the primary against the behemoth Hillary Clinton. Given more time, I think he would have overtaken it. But yes, Bernie Sanders had a similar thing going to Donald Trump in that he had fewer people supporting him, but a giant enthusiasm gap where people were like, Hillary Clinton, okay. But the people who liked Bernie, myself included, were like, yes, Bernie, because his policies were spot on. So it's the same thing. Bernie had way bigger rallies than Hillary Clinton, and what ended up happening? We all know what ended up happening. So Eric Bolling is a clown. Eric Bolling is a poll denier. But the only little grain of truth is the enthusiasm gap there. That doesn't mean Trump is winning. That doesn't mean he's up in the polls. He's not. He's definitely a clear underdog right now. But yes, he does have enthusiastic supporters. Okay. Next. For the first time maybe ever, I will be giving a CNN host some credit. Kate Baldwin of CNN covered a story on the devastation ongoing in Syria, and it really struck a nerve here.
Today, the United Nations is asking for 48 hours of relief in the fighting to break from the violence between the government regime and rebel forces. In 5 years of war, more than 250,000 people have lost their lives. That includes 4,500 children in Aleppo alone. Millions more displaced without a home. Now that includes Omran. And what strikes me is we shed tears, but there are no tears here. He doesn't cry once. The little boy is in total shock. He's stunned inside his home one moment and the next, lost in the flurry and the fury of war and chaos. At least three people were killed by this bomb in this neighborhood. This is Omran. He's alive. We wanted you to know.
Yeah, a lot of people in old school mainstream media will look at that and say she violated journalistic ethics because she teared up, and you can't do that, you can't show emotion, you shouldn't show emotion, you shouldn't be biased in one direction or another, you got to present the news, it's got to be dry, it's got to be vanilla, yada yada. I don't agree with that in any way, shape, or form. You know, I think that when you have a normal response to a serious issue affecting other human beings, that shows that you care about other human beings. That shows that, in my opinion, you're being actually objective. Isn't that like a fairly objective response to seeing a little boy who was just pulled out of the rubble of an airstrike and he's covered in dust and he's bleeding and he's in total shock and he's not crying? Isn't that the normal human response? Oh my goodness, how the fuck could this happen? Look at what we're watching right now. So I actually think in many ways that's more objective, and that makes you more relatable and more of a actual human being. And it's one of the best things, or, you know, it's weird to call it best in this context given the disaster that she's looking at. But I think everybody knows what I'm saying here. It's one of the better responses, and it's one of the better pieces of coverage on CNN that I've seen in a while. So I think Kate Baldwin was right for that response. And look, this made news everywhere else, and now it's raising awareness about a very serious issue. But then obviously this branches off into the bigger issue. In Syria, what do we do about it? Because I've described to you, I think we've probably covered the Syria situation in more detail than almost anybody else in all the different versions and forms of media combined. So you guys know on one side you have the Assad government, so the Syrian government. You have various Shia militias. You have Hezbollah, for example.
You have the people who, Russia, people who are fighting to keep the Assad government in power. And then on the other side, you have rebel factions, at this point, the majority of which are Islamists and jihadists. So you have ISIS. We all know who they are. You have al-Nusra Front, which at one point was officially al-Qaeda in Syria. Now they've distanced themselves from al-Qaeda, but it's not like they've dropped their belief in Sharia. And it's not like they aren't jihadists anymore. They are. You have the FSA, which are more moderate rebels, but according to recent reports, the FSA has diminished in power, and the FSA, you know, they're more of a minor player now than they used to be. At the beginning, you could have said, you know what, some of the Syrian rebels were more moderate, and there was a moment there, a brief flicker in time where maybe you could have had a transition government away from Assad, and it could have been, you know, a democratic secular Syria or something in a different direction with the rebels. But now it appears like that position and that point in time has largely passed. And again, we have mostly Islamists and jihadist rebels. So given the fact that you have, you know, very unsavory characters who are leading the rebel movement right now, given the fact that you have the Assad government, who, according to many reports, they're no angels either. They are responsible for many civilian deaths as well. What do you do? So when you look at Omran and you say, okay, I want to help the kid. I want to help the kid. But how do you help the kid? What do you do to help the kid? It's not easy. There's no easy answer. There's no easy answer. So look, when you try to be as rigidly objective as possible as you can about this, I mean, I guess the first thing you'd think of is, well, there's got to be some sort of diplomatic way to solve this. There's got to be some way to sit down and negotiate and compromise and come to a, you know, a reasonable middle ground, or just a reasonable deal overall, where you have Russia sit down with the United States, you have the Syrian government involved, you have, you know, the people who are funding the rebel movement, so Saudi Arabia, Turkey, you have all these people sit down, you know, or you have representatives from each government, you have representatives from the different fighting factions actually in Syria. They all sit down and they all have to iron out a plan that's somewhat agreeable and get a ceasefire going. That does appear, though, to be pretty impossible. They've tried to do some ceasefires. I don't know the other details of said deals in Syria, and it just they fall apart, and they fall apart because the sides are so, you know, far apart from each other. And then look, people who say, well, this proves the U.S. should get more involved. Guys, the U.S. has, there's already been stories, and we've covered them, of the CIA arming one group of people in Syria and the Pentagon arming another group of people in Syria, and then those groups fighting each other. You think we just wave a magic American magic wand? A magic American magic wand. Nice double magic. And then all of a sudden, poof, everything's better. No, because we are involved, we've been involved, and it's not really getting better. If anything, it's getting worse. So what is the answer? I don't know what the answer is. I don't know, you know, what you do. And if you can't get a diplomatic solution, a negotiated deal with all sides where I don't know what the answer would be, a shared power government, or you split up Syria, or I don't know. Well, then what do? The only other thing you could think of is UN involvement on a larger scale where, you know, wherever there's a clear genocide of civilians happening, they prevent it. So, for example, we cover the story. It was Amnesty International released a report. Many of the Syrian rebels are doing torture. They're doing executions. They've banned music in these areas, again, because these are Islamists and jihadists, mostly. So what do? Do you have the UN try to get involved there and fight them back and then set up a zone where the civilians can be not harmed and they're in communication with both sides and the airstrikes avoid the UN camp? I don't know. To me, when I hear that, it's a good idea, but it's easier on paper. It's easier said than done. And then also, the only other third option I could think of is, well, you just continue to aid the people who you know are on the right side no matter what. So in other words, you can't risk going, like the U.S. had tried, we're going to arm Sunni militias to go in there and fight ISIS and Assad. Well, that didn't work because eventually, when they went into Syria, they just handed over their weapons to al-Nusra, which again, at the time, is al-Qaeda in Syria. And so you just arm jihadists when you were trying to not do that and you were trying to fight ISIS and fight the Assad government. So you can't roll the dice on, you know, these questionable groups. So then what do you do? Who do you arm? I mean, the only group of people who we know for sure, hey, they're on the right side no matter what here, are various Kurdish groups. So, you know, if you want to give an extensive amount of aid to Kurdish groups, okay, I guess that's a step in the right direction, because we know that they care deeply about not harming civilians and they're on the right side of everything here. Or, I don't know, the Shia militias that aren't committing atrocities, who, and there are many that are, but the Shia militias who are fighting the right groups and we know they're targeting ISIS and they actually give a shit about civilian casualties, do you give aid to them? Again, I don't know, but it seems like these are the only three options and none of them are easy. But when we see a picture like that, all of us go, we got to do something. But something is not by definition good. You could fuck it up, and we have fucked it up. We've armed jihadists and Islamists. You know, we've further destabilized the region. We know what U.S. interventions recently have looked like. It's made problems worse. So what do you do? The only options I see are some sort of a negotiated deal through diplomacy with all the sides involved. That's hard to do. Perhaps U.N. involvement just to stop potential pockets of genocide from happening. That's also hard to do. And aid to the Kurds and maybe some Shia militias who we know aren't committing atrocities. That's all I got. After that, I'm out. I don't know what the answer is. And honestly, overall, it appears like what we're looking at in Syria, it's a civil war. That's what it is. So is it a sad fact of reality that civil wars have to play themselves out with all their destruction and death and devastation, and we all have to sit on the sidelines, handicapped to do anything, because that's just the nature of the beast that we're looking at right now? Maybe that is the case. And my heart bleeds for every single person in Syria who's affected in a negative way. But again, I don't have a good answer. Nobody has a good answer. Anybody who tells you, this is what we do and that's it, they're simpletons. Everybody knows it's a complex situation. It's multifaceted. And there is no way to just guarantee, we'll fix it tomorrow. So beware the people who come along and say, I got the answer. No, you don't. Nobody does. It's a horrible situation. I hope we have fewer situations like Omran. I feel horrible for all the civilians there. But I just don't know what the solution is, and nobody does. Okay. Take a quick break. When we come back, I'll get into Jill Stein stuff and awesome Donald Trump flip-flops. Stay right there.
All right, we're back, guys. I got a lot to get to, so I had to come back pretty quickly here. All right, let's go to Donald Trump's flip-flops here on the Iraq War. This is amazing. I love it when you just snip it back to back to back and see all the different things he said. Huffington Post compiled video evidence of all of Donald Trump's positions and flip-flops on the Iraq War. Let's watch.
I'm the only person up here,
the only one,
that fought against going into Iraq.
You, I didn't want to go into Iraq.
I've been against it for years.
Did you oppose the war before the invasion in March of 2003?
I opposed it all the time.
Is there a record of that?
You have to understand, probably.
I mean, you can look back to 2004, 2003.
2002, 2003.
Are you for invading Iraq?
Yeah, I guess. So, you know, I wish it was. I wish the first time it was done correctly.
Did you think, Howard, that you thought it was a good idea?
No, this was before the war started.
It looks like a tremendous success from a military standpoint.
The war is a total catastrophe.
Who do you blame?
And they have a civil war going on.
Who do you blame?
Well, there's only one person you can blame, and that's our current president. I would like to see our president get us out of the war.
You know how they get out? They get out. That's how they get out. Declare victory and leave.
I would announce that we have been victorious in Iraq, and all the troops are coming home. And let those people have their civil war. Anybody that wants more troops going over to Iraq, I think, can't win an election.
What?
Iraq, we shouldn't have been there, and I get them out real fast.
We shouldn't be out of there. We should have left our 20,000 soldiers there.
They should have left soldiers behind, like 20,000.
We
should have left some people.
They deceived us because they didn't take care of the Kurds. They didn't take care of the whole thing. ISIS formed because these people were not allowed to partake.
We just took everybody and left, and hence the creation, essentially, of ISIS.
President Obama. He is the founder.
Founder.
He's the founder of ISIS.
You said the president was the founder of ISIS. I know what you meant. You meant that he created the vacuum, he lost the peace.
No, I meant he's the founder of ISIS.
So I said, the founder of ISIS. Obviously, I'm being sarcastic. Then, but not that sarcastic.
Okay, I have a confession to make. I actually enjoy watching Trump press conferences, Trump speeches, because they are fucking entertaining. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't want the guy to lead the country because he's a thin-skinned fascist buffoon, but man, is it fun watching him. You know, he's one of those people where when he talks, you listen and you follow every word. There's no, like, most of the time, or maybe this is just me because I guess I have ADD, but sometimes when people talk, it's like you're listening and you kind of go in and out of paying attention to them, especially if it's a political speech and it goes on and on. You know, you're 6 minutes in and you're like, okay, what am I having for lunch and blah, 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 blah. With Trump, it's like, no, you're listening because he's fucking up there and he's really entertaining. So there's another angle of hypocrisy here that I didn't know about. I knew about the Howard Stern right before the invasion. Are you in favor of it? Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I wish we did it right the first time, which would have been an equally stupid idea when we did the first Iraq war. If we were like, you know what, fuck it, let's go take out Saddam. And in the meantime, it would have been just as disastrous. But so I knew about that, and then obviously he was, I'm against it, except we have video, you know, or audio evidence that you weren't. But now there's the angle of, I get out completely. What do you mean? How do you get out? You get out by getting out. That's how you get out. He's like, oh, yeah, we should get everybody out there. Get everybody out there. Let them have a civil war. Get everybody out there. Everybody out there. And then there's other times where he's like, well, come on. We can't leave irresponsibly. You got to leave, like, 20,000 troops there. Wait, what the fuck? You're there repeatedly. Get out, get out, get out, please. Get out, get out, get out, get out. And he's like, well, now I can get out. Leave behind residual force. Obviously, like 20,000 troops. Wait, which is it? Which is it? Which is it? Which is it? So, I mean, but this is Trump 101, flip-flop on absolutely everything, contradict yourself on absolutely everything. And to be fair to Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, same boat, bitch, or like crazy. She flip-flops like a motherfucker, too, and she's contradicted herself a trillion times. So this gets back to my main thesis on issues like this, which is the people who are fervent supporters of Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, the people who, like, defend them no matter what till they're red in the fucking face, you're in a personality cult. That's what it is. It's a personality cult. Because it's not like Hillary Clinton, oh, she represents this consistent philosophy over all the years. It's not like Donald Trump, oh, consistent philosophy over all the years. Like, oh, if you believe X or Y or Z, well, that's your person because that's what he stood for this entire time. No. No. The people who support them and are over the top about it and fawning and fervent and diehard in their adoration and gushing love. We all know, man. It's just, I like him. I don't know. I like him. I like how he talks. I like how he makes me feel. I like his style. I like him. I just fucking like him. I like what he represents in my mind. It ain't about the issues, because it can't be about the issues, because he's been on every side of every issue. Hillary Clinton, same thing. I don't know. I like her. I fucking like her. That's, I like her, so I'm just going to defend her. Well, that's really, really sad. It is. It's so sad. Man, say what you want about Bernie supporters. You didn't get that from Bernie supporters, dude. Bernie supporters are like, yeah, let me tell you exactly why I like him. Have a seat. He's for single-payer health care. Love it. He's for raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. He's the one that was pushing that idea. He's the one who says we need to treat climate change like a World War II-level threat. That's 100% right. And then they'll give you a million policy reasons. Whereas the Hillary people are like, I'm with her, hashtag. The Trump people are like, yeah! Success, make America great again. Make it great. Woo! How do you want to do that? Whatever he wants to do, man. You could go up to Trump supporters and tell them Donald Trump believes X, Y, and Z, and make X, Y, and Z things that Obama did that Trump said he hated. They'd be like, as long as Trump's for it, I'm for it, man. Woo! So we're dealing with children here, man, and we got two massively disliked candidates for a reason, because rational people are like, these are the two fuckers you came up with at over 300 million people in the country? For shame. Okay. Now we go to Jill Stein. I actually have a bunch of clips with Jill Stein. Actually continuing to put them in order here as I talk to you guys. Don't tell anybody. Okay, here we are. Jill Stein was asked a question about foreign policy and ISIS at the Green Town Hall on CNN this week. Let's see what her plan is.
You said that you opposed the use of U.S. forces overseas. U.S. forces are currently engaged in airstrikes against ISIS and other military operations. My question is, do you consider ISIS to be a threat to the U.S. or to U.S. allies and partners in the Middle East? And if so, what would you do to defeat ISIS that the Obama administration is not currently doing?
So, you know, there are rules of engagement, international rules, that if you're going to attack another country, you need to be at imminent threat of being actually attacked by them. Clearly, that threshold has not been met. ISIS is not about to launch a major attack against our country. And we have a track record now of fighting terrorism, not only ISIS, but Al-Qaeda before it, the Taliban before that. And this track record is not looking so good. We have spent $6 trillion, according to a recent Harvard study, when you include the costs, the ongoing costs of health care for our wounded veterans who deserve the highest care possible. $6 trillion, which since 2001, we have killed 1 million people in Iraq alone, which is not winning us the hearts and minds in the Middle East. We have lost tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers that have been killed or severely wounded. And what do we have to show for this? Failed states, mass refugee migrations, and repeated terrorist threats that get worse with each cycle. So ISIS grew out of the catastrophe of Iraq. Al-Qaeda, in turn, grew out of Afghanistan. And in fact, in Afghanistan, it was the CIA and the Saudis together who created the first so-called jihadi movement with the Mujahideen in order to make trouble against the Soviet Union. So this has been a very ill-conceived plan that has been backfiring madly against us. So what we say is that we need a new kind of offensive in the Middle East, because bombing terrorism and shooting terrorism is not quelling terrorism, it's only fanning the flames of terrorism, the misery and the poverty that drive terrorism. We are calling for a new kind of offensive, a peace offensive in the Middle East that begins with a weapons embargo. And since we are supplying, we the U.S. is supplying the majority of the weapons to actually all combatants, we and our allies are arming most of the fighting forces in the Middle East, we can initiate that weapons embargo. And we also call for a freeze on the funding of those countries who continue to support jihadi terrorist enterprises.
That answer was damn near perfect. So, she says, let's try this radical idea. How about you use U.S. military force and you can start a war when we are under direct threat of imminent attack? That is the exact same standard we would expect from any other country on the planet, except maybe Israel and Saudi and maybe Britain we'd let slide too. But pretty much everybody else, we'd be like, okay, you want to start a war. Are you under direct threat of imminent attack, and is it to defend your country? Is the answer yes? Proceed. Is the answer no? Then you're the problem. You're the one doing the offensive war. So, no. But we're above that, bro. Offensive wars, that's what we do. But when we do offensive wars, it's cool. It's cool. We're the good guys by definition. International law, schminternational schlaw. What she's saying is, I know this is totally crazy, but how about maybe we abide by the same rules and laws that we want everybody else to abide by, and we can use our military for defense? That used to be the duh position. It used to be the case that if anybody disagreed with that, you'd be like, whoa, 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 whoa. You want to do an offensive war? What the fuck is wrong with you, man? But now we're just so used to war that it's like, is it brunch yet? Have you invaded a new country? Get on that. So, 100% right on that. And look, I think I'm almost in total agreement with her. I would say I also have no problem, though, with, if you want to aid the people who are on the front lines fighting ISIS, and we know that they're fighting ISIS, and we know that they're people who, their value system align with ours, the guns are not going to be turned on us, well, then I have no problem with you giving them aid. For example, if you want to give the Kurds aid. Now, perhaps we don't do as much as we can on that front because of our relationship with Turkey, and we don't want to piss off Turkey because Turkey hates the Kurds, so on and so forth. But I'm comfortable with the idea of giving aid to the Kurds, because it's not like arming the Mujahideen, where they eventually became the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and then they turned the weapons on us. The Kurds are a different story. So perhaps maybe I go a little further than Jill in that if you want to have a good strategy against ISIS, you could aid people and perhaps even arm people who are on the front line fighting ISIS who we know are good people. And then also, again, maybe I go a little further than Jill in that when there's a genocide happening, because when I talk about my non-interventionist position, but oftentimes the logical response is, yeah, well, what about Rwanda? What about when that happens? What are you going to do? Sit there with your thumb up your ass and let people fucking kill people, slaughter people as you're doing nothing? The problem there was that we didn't intervene. That's the argument people use. And my response is, no, but you're fucking conflating two things. One is U.S. military power, us using our army to do X, Y, or Z. That's one thing. It's another thing. If there's a genocide going on, do I have problem with a full-scale UN intervention where the international community all come together and we attack a problem together so that the U.S. is not one nation above other nations but one nation among other nations? Well, there I have no problem with intervention as long as it's a UN intervention and we all do it together, because when you have one nation above other nations, you set up a perverse incentive. And the Rwanda instances and the instances of actual atrocities happening, then, later on, a nation above other nations gets to use that as a cover for we get to go anywhere and do anything, and maybe if we jack some natural resources, whatever, look away because we're the world police and we're so altruistic and we care about human rights.
So you want to stop, you want to nip that problem in the bud of one nation being above other nations, because we're only human beings, and human beings are not perfect, and we have poor incentives. So if you attack the problem together, and the UN does it, well, then I'm fine with an intervention. Of course the UN should intervene when there's an actual out-and-out genocide going on somewhere. So maybe in that respect, I go a little further than Jill Stein, but honestly, that's probably not even the case, because I feel like if I bring this up to her, she'd be like, no, of course, I'd do that, totally. But then the heart of her anti-terrorism plan is, stop funding them, jackass! Which is like www.duh.com. And people go, well, what do you mean? We're not doing that now. Oh yeah? Is that right? We're not doing that now? We just gave Saudi Arabia over $1 billion in weapons. They turned around and started bombing civilians in Yemen immediately. They bombed a school and they bombed a Doctors Without Borders hospital this week. Okay, but that doesn't get in the hands of terrorists. Wrong. Saudi Arabia arms Sunni militias fighting on the ground in Yemen against the Houthi Shia rebels. Who are those Sunni militias? Al-Qaeda. They've also armed rebels in Syria. The majority of rebels in Syria at this point are Islamists and jihadists. You know, you have Saudi Arabia spread Wahhabism throughout the world, this poisonous, toxic, ultra-conservative, fundamentalist interpretation of Islam. Step number one in being serious about fighting jihadism and ISIS and Al-Qaeda is stop funding them. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Furthermore, in Syria, the CIA is arming one set of rebels. The Pentagon is arming another set of rebels. Those rebels are fighting each other. We had a program where we train Syrian rebels. Guess what happened? The second they got into Syria, they turned over their weapons to al-Nusra, which was al-Qaeda in Syria. Okay, step number one. Jill is 100% right. Stop arming them. Stop funding them. And also, here's a crazy idea. Look at the evidence and the data. So we started the war on terror. Well over a decade later, there are now more terrorists than there were before. So whatever strategy you're using hasn't fucking worked. So all the run-and-gun, cowboy, shoot-em-up mentality, it's made the problem worse. Our drone program hits the wrong target 90% of the time. I wonder if that's going to create more terrorists and anti-Americanism throughout the Middle East. That's a hard one. I wonder if CIA black sites where torture goes on gives ISIS a propaganda victory and then helps recruit more people. Did you know when ISIS was executing people, remember when they were executing journalists not that long ago, a little over a year ago? They were wearing orange jumpsuits. Why? Well, they said this is because of the people who were at Guantanamo who were wearing this. So how about we don't give them a fucking victory in the propaganda realm? We don't torture innocent people, which we've done. We don't kill innocent people with drones, which we've done. We're not, fucking brazen in our civilian casualty rate. I mean, look at the civilian deaths in Iraq. So what Jill is saying is stop creating more terrorists and stop arming the terrorists. And outside of that, yes, we can use our military for self-defense. Wild! No, except it's common sense, and it's the only person in this twilight zone of a presidential race at this point who's making any sense. Okay. All right, let's go to Jill Stein and the Lesser of Two Evils. Jill Stein weighed in on voting for the Lesser of Two Evils. Let's see what she has to say.
Dr. Stein, given the way our political system works, effectively you could help Donald Trump like Ralph Nader helped George Bush in 2000. How could you sleep at night?
I will have trouble sleeping at night if Donald Trump is elected. I will also have trouble sleeping at night if Hillary Clinton is elected. And as despicable as Donald Trump's words are, I find Hillary Clinton's actions and track record is very troubling. So Donald Trump, bashes immigrants and is a xenophobic and racist loudmouth. But Hillary Clinton, has been promoting these wars that have killed a million black and brown people in Iraq, for example. The Democratic Party has become the party of deportation and detentions and night raids with you know, millions of people deported under Barack Obama. Some of them include the refugees from Honduras, where Hillary Clinton gave the thumbs up to a coup from which thousands of people have been fleeing, who have not been welcomed into this country. And Hillary, in fact, has supported many of the White House policies of deportation and detentions. On, you know, the issue of nuclear war, I am very concerned about trouble breaking out in Syria in this air war that Hillary is threatening to have. So, you know, as disturbing as Donald Trump's talk is, I find Hillary Clinton's track record is actually very much of concern, too. This politics of fear that tells you you've got to vote against the person you most dislike or the person you are most afraid of, that politics of fear has a track record, because a lot of people have been, you know, that's been like the prevailing mythology. You got to vote your fears, not your values. And what has that delivered? You know, all the reasons you're told to vote for the lesser evil, because you didn't want the expanding wars, you didn't want the meltdown of the climate or the Wall Street bailouts or the deportation of immigrants. That's exactly what we've gotten by allowing ourselves to be silent.
Okay, so pretty much all of that is spot on. I have almost 100% agreement with what she said there. It's a very important message. People need to hear it, and people need to act accordingly. I have to add, though, and this is where some people will get mad at me, but you have to keep two separate thoughts in your mind at the same time. Both of them are super important. Point number one is every single fucking thing Jill Stein just said right there. Totally true, totally on point. Point number two is, even with all of that being true, and it is, either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton will be president. It ain't going to be Jill Stein. She cannot win with the way the system is structured. She's not even on every single ballot. So understand, again, and people are going to get mad at me, but whatever, they have to get a harsh dose of reality. Everything Jill said there is true. Both parties blow donkey nuts, if that's a thing. If it's not, I just made it a thing. But either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton will be president. So, with that being the case, I know it feels icky to do and it's gross, but you really have to ask yourself, who is worse? Now, she says, you know, I won't be able to sleep at night if Donald Trump wins or if Hillary Clinton wins. Yeah, that's spot on. That's totally true. But there are varying degrees. So if Trump wins, I won't be able to sleep at all the entire night. If Hillary wins, maybe I get 2 hours. I'm supposed to get 8, but maybe I'll get 2. There's a difference there. And, you know, I feel like if you were to bring this up to Jill's face, she would go, yeah, of course, you know, that is true. There is such a thing. Even though the whole concept of the lesser of two evils is gross, that doesn't mean there's not an answer in the realm of who actually is the lesser of two evils. So I would argue, as you guys have heard me say before, we don't need to get into all the nuances of it right now, but when you have Trump saying, hey, on the Supreme Court, I'm going to pick the next Justice Scalia. When he says that, honestly, on that alone, you can say Hillary's the lesser of two evils, because that can do unmitigated disaster for decades to come if you actually pick Scalia 2.0 to be on the court at this crucial point in history. You can't do it, man. You can't do it. Everybody listening knows. And I hate Merrick Garland. I despise him. But is Merrick Garland better than the next Justice Scalia? There's not even a debate there. There's not even a question there. If you think there is a question, you are waging a war on nuance in your own mind. Also, he says, I'm going to rip up the Paris Agreement, the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Okay, again, that's another one. Hillary Clinton is horrible on the issue of climate change because she sold fracking all around the world. But she ain't going to rip up the Paris Climate Agreement, and she says she's not going to. He says, I'm going to do it. He's worse. He is worse. She's bad. He's worse. I know it's hard to get, but it's true. And then also, freedom of the press. I mean, he's shown over and over. He has no regard for that. Now, she's not the most transparent, obviously. Neither is Obama. Obama's not really all that transparent either. He's been terrible on this issue. But when Trump literally bans every journalist and reporter and outlet who says shit he doesn't like from his campaign events, when he sues Bill Maher over a joke, when he sues The Onion over satire,
okay, this is a guy who is on a whole nother level of disrespecting free press, free expression, so on and so forth. And then he says he's implied before, I'll just make a deal on U.S. debt. So, like, yeah, I'll default on U.S. debt and make a deal. Because this is what he did with his businesses. Oh, I'll go bankrupt and I'll just fix it afterwards. You can't do that with U.S. debt, dipshit. You're going to talk about a worldwide depression. He doesn't know. So you can't trust him with the economy like that. Again, not that Hillary's good, but she's obviously not as insane as Trump on that. Torture. I'm going to torture. Yeah, I'll bring it back, even if it doesn't work. Hillary's horrible on foreign policy and on a million other things. She ain't saying that shit, and she won't do that shit. So, again, both things are true at the same time. Everything Jill said is true, and also you're going to have to ask yourself and answer at some point, who would you prefer of those two? Because one of them is going to win. Now, the out that most people use is, I just think it's 50-50. You know that's an out. Yes, they're both bad. Again, I'm agreeing 100%. But is it 50-50? Is it literally? So you go down the line with all the different issues. Is it really literally 50-50? On all these different issues, Trump is bad. On the same number of issues, Hillary's bad. There's no varying degrees of bad. It's just, you know, they're equal. I would venture to guess you haven't really sat down and went through all the nooks and crannies of the different policy ideas to come to that conclusion. And then, finally, let me just say this. You all know my take. I'm in a solid blue state. Who am I voting for? Jill Stein. If I was in any solid blue or solid red state, who am I voting for? Jill Stein. Why? I'm sending a fucking message, man. I'm sending a message. You know, the Democratic Party, will they hear something if they go, holy shit, that's a record for Green Party votes. I've never seen that many. Wow. They're really trying to tell some. Oh, my God, Hillary Clinton just barely edged out a fascist orange-faced buffoon. Is that going to send a message? I think that would send a little bit of a message. So if you're in a solid blue state, solid red state, if I was in a solid blue or solid red state, yeah, I'm voting for Jill Stein. But if I was in a swing state, would I cry and shit myself and vote for Hillary and be like, oh, I hate my life and regret it for the next fucking 4 years? Yeah, but I think it's a civic duty, to be honest. I would view it as my civic duty if it was in that situation to avoid the potential Armageddon-like scenario. And even with all this being said, I got to be clear, I don't agree with Jill on everything. You know, I feel like people get the misimpression sometimes when I cover these stories, and even with Bernie, back when you cover Bernie stories, oh, what, do you agree with him on everything? No, I don't. I don't. So, for example, with Jill Stein, I totally disagree with her on GMOs. Now, I'm cool with GMO labeling just because more facts are never a bad thing, and if people want to know, let them know. You got nothing to hide. But in terms of, are GMOs actually dangerous? No, not at all. In fact, the science is overwhelming on that. We've covered stories. I'll leave a link in the video description box right here. I covered a story, you know, I don't know how many years ago it was, but all of the scientific information on GMOs is crystal clear. There's a scientific consensus, just like climate change. Liberals always say on climate change, what do you mean? There's a consensus. So why are the idiot anti-science Republicans arguing against it? That's right. Why are they? They're idiots. So why would people argue against the scientific consensus on GMOs? It's just that a lot of people don't know that there's a scientific consensus on GMOs, and they're scared by the fear-mongering. So, and by the way, this doesn't mean Monsanto is good. No, they're horrible. And this doesn't mean that, for example, different pesticides don't have serious issues and, you know, potentially cancer-causing, yada, yada. All that's true, too. But it also is the case, if you go by the data, if you go by the information, if you go by the science, I think GMOs should be labeled, but they're not bad for you. Almost everything is genetically modified. So I disagree with her on that. I think she's fallen into the camp of doing fear-mongering over GMOs, and so I think she's horribly off base on that front. Also, in the Green Party platform, I don't know if it's there this time around, but in previous platforms, they fucking pander with alternative medicine. Oh, we need to go holistic approaches and homeopathy. That's all total bullshit. People think the pharmaceutical companies are peddling bullshit. The only people peddling bigger bullshit are fucking homeopathic companies, alternative medicine companies. You know what alternative medicine would be called if it worked? Medicine. You wouldn't need to call it alternative medicine. It would just be medicine. So that's bullshit, and they're ripping you off. And I think the Green Party has fallen into that trap. Certainly previously, I don't know what it's like today. And I really don't agree with Jill on nuclear weapons. Jill keeps up. We got to, like, fucking eliminate them. Really? Like, I don't even think that's possible, dude. Like, oh, we got rid of ours. So, Russia, you're good, right? You destroy yours? Oh, no, they didn't. Like, that's not a thing. Like, and you're fucked either way. So you keep nuclear weapons, you're fucked because we're escalating towards Armageddon. You get rid of them, you're fucked because you don't know if anybody else got rid of them. And if anybody else didn't get rid of them, all of a sudden they're the number one superpower and they can control everything. And the cat's out of the bag, dude. It's gone. You can't get rid of nukes. So this idea, like, well, we're going to try, I don't think that's reasonable. I don't think that's possible. And I think it's a little pie in the sky, naive. So do I agree with Jill on everything? No. In fact, I have vehement disagreements with her on many things. But that being said, she's by far and away better than Trump and Hillary. That's not even close. Not even close. Which is why, even though she can't win, she cannot win, I still think if you're in a solidly safe state, or certainly I'm in New York, I'm in a solidly safe state, I'm going to be voting for her. Okay. I gotta skip this last break, obviously, because I got a lot more to get to. So, let's go to her plan on college debt. Jill Stein laid out her plan on college debt earlier in the week in a CNN town hall. Let's watch.
So, the question becomes, something as enticing as erasing all student debt begs the question, how could you ever do that? How?
So, let me say first, we found a way to bail out Wall Street. And when we needed the money, we found it, including about $17 trillion worth of practically zero interest loans, which was made available, as needed. We found a way to bail out Wall Street, the guys that crashed the economy with their waste, fraud, and abuse. So my point is, as responsible adults, we need to bail out a younger generation that is held hostage in this unpayable student debt. It's terrible for them. It's terrible for our whole society, because it's always the younger generation that leads us forward to create the economy of the future and to lead the social changes that we urgently need right now.
But the concept itself, as enticing as it is, there's one apples to oranges thing here. Quantitative easing, which you've talked about, TARP, TALF, whatever acronym you want to throw at how we dealt with the banks in 2008, right or wrong, those loans, zero interest in some cases, some not, were repaid.
That's right.
So that would not erase student debt, right? Because
right.
No matter
yes.
What interest rate is, you still got the principal.
Right.
So how do you do this? Because it's not going to be the same mechanism as you had with the banks, because they repaid the loans.
That's right.
How would you ever get a Congress that wants to do nothing like this to do anything like this?
So, you know, it was easy for the banks to repay the loans because they're an extremely advantaged and privileged group. They get the money at zero interest. They loan it out at 7%. So it's really easy for them to pay back those loans. Young people are not in that situation. They don't have the jobs that we need. We don't have an economy that can employ them. So here's what I'm suggesting. That debt is largely owned now by the federal government, the vast bulk of it. I'm suggesting that the Federal Reserve actually buy that debt, like it did for Wall Street, but in this case, that it buy that debt and it basically declare that debt null and void, which essentially means that the Federal Reserve would be expanding the money supply into the hands of young people, so that they can spend it into the economy instead of having to pay back the loans with their hard-earned dollars. They now own their hard-earned dollars.
Yeah. Here's my response to that. Why not do it? Because, you know, people, I feel like we coast off the momentum of the system as it is right now. So any change is like, ooh, we're changing stuff. This is wild. But once you do the change, it's easy to look back and say, I can't believe we used to do it that other way. That was fucking crazy. you know, so for example, I know this is a weird pivot, and it's you know, going on totally on a different topic here, but like when there was segregation, officially segregation in the South, people thought, well, what do you mean? There's segregation, of course. That's not going to change. It's segregation. It's here. Duh. But then when you change that and you change the laws, you know, 5 years on, you go, I can't believe you should do it that way, and like everybody was cool with it. So it's the same thing with student loan debt. Like we have over $1 trillion worth of student loan debt, and we're all just like, yeah, student loan debt. What do you mean? That's what happened. That's what it is. There's $1 trillion worth of student loan debt. Duh, that's fine. Yeah, but if we get rid of it, everybody will go, well, why the fuck did we ever have it? That was the dumbest thing ever in human history. So I feel like it's these, like, that's Chris Cuomo's whole reaction to that is, like, you know, apoplectic and perplexed. Like, whoa, actually make things better? Why are you so crazy, Miss Jill Stein? So let me go ahead and give you some facts here to really put this in perspective. Did you know $100 billion a year is spent on 800 U.S. military bases overseas? 800. 800 we have. You know, you think we could get by with maybe 172? Just a thought. Just a thought. $100 billion every year is wasted on that. Every year. $90 billion a year is dodged by corporations in offshore tax havens. $90 billion a year. They just put overseas, Cayman Islands, Bermuda. Well, what do you mean? We didn't do anything wrong. But if you paid your fucking taxes, like everybody else has to do, we'd have $90 billion more. And what they're debating here is, where are we going to get $1 trillion? How can we wipe $1 trillion off, you know, the slate? How can we eliminate that debt? Well, here's just something. $100 billion a year for 800 military bases. $90 billion a year because corporations dodge taxes and offshore tax havens. And $4 billion a year, for example, goes as a fucking welfare check to ExxonMobil for research and development, even though why do you need an incentive to do research and development? You're one of the most profitable corporations on the planet. Isn't that incentive enough to do research and development? How fucking stupid is that? $85 billion a month still goes to Wall Street. A month! And then finally, Jill actually undersold it. The real number, by the year 2053, the Iraq war will cost us $7 trillion. $7 trillion. $7 trillion. So we could find the money to invade and occupy a country that didn't attack us, but we can't find one-seventh that amount of money to wipe out student loan debt. And then I haven't even brought up the fact that, you know, the massive upsides of this? So when you give all these young people who are saddled with student loan debt, when you give them that money, so they don't have to pay it to the banks anymore, now they have the money, well, then they can spend it on other shit. And then the economy's better off. So it actually helps. It's actually a good thing. It'd be good for the economy. But no, it's a change. So we can't do that because change is weird. It makes me feel icky. So, like, let's just continue to fuck over our young college kids and make them basically indentured servitudes. Or how about no? How about that? Okay. All right, let's go to, how many more do I have on Jill? I got one more on Jill Stein. Ooh, no, wrong. Two more on Jill Stein. And then I really hope I get to those last two stories because they're super important. Jill Stein was asked a gotcha question by an audience member at the Green Party Town Hall. Let's see how she handles it.
Dr. Stein, I have a little bit of a concern. I know that you're advocating for boycotting Israel, and I just want to know, why do you single out Israel, being that they are a democratic ally to us, where why don't you do the same for other Middle Eastern states, and many of which are committing horrific crimes and abuse of people?
So let me reassure you, Maria, that's exactly what we are doing. And I've been very careful to avoid that pitfall of targeting Israel. And what we say is that we are turning over a new chapter because we ourselves have been as guilty of this as any of our allies. But what we would say under a green administration, if we turn the White House into a greenhouse, what we're saying is that our foreign policy will be based on international law and human rights. So when we say to Israel that we will not continue to give you $8 million a day when the Israeli army is occupying territory in Palestine, conducting home demolitions and assassinations and things of that sort that are recognized by the UN, we're not going to do it for the Saudis either. They don't get a pass whatsoever, nor for that matter does Egypt get a pass with their incredible human rights violations, and we're giving them not as much, but we're giving them billions of dollars.
Have you advocated to boycott Saudi Arabia?
Yes, absolutely. That's right.
That exchange gives me life. Because she is trying to get her. Oh, I gotcha! I fucking gotcha! Oh, you're harder on Israel than everybody else! But she's like, no, yeah, of course. So, Jill, why do you single out Israel? I don't. Okay, but then why would do you single out Israel? I don't. So, Jill, but have you called for a boycott on Saudi Arabia? Yes. Oh, that feels so good. Oh, that's awesome. So, understand, and the reason why this is great is that I've experienced this too. So whenever I go after Israel and I say, hey, you should probably stop doing occupation, and you should probably stop oppressing the Palestinians, and you should probably do a two-state deal, and you should probably start having an apartheid state. Whenever you say that, oh, a lot of people get mad, and they say, well, you're saying about Israel, I don't want to say about Saudi Arabia, other countries in the region. And what's the implication when they say that? When they try to get you on that, why are you being so hard on Israel? Why are you singling them out, Jill? Why are you singling them out, Kyle? What's the implication? Fucking anti-Semite. You're singling out Israel. You're not talking about the surrounding countries. Just so happens the people in Israel, they're mostly Jewish. It's a Jewish state, right? So, I mean, you're singling them out. I'm not saying you're an anti-Semite, but you're singling them out. Have you called for a boycott on the other places? And across the board, whether it's myself, whether it's Jill Stein, many other people who I've seen make the argument, we should boycott Israel or we should join the BDS movement, boycott, divestments, and sanctions. They're saying, hey, let's do that so that we can try to get a peace deal and that we can stop the occupation and the oppression and the apartheid state. But people, they spin that as if like, well, that just means you're an anti-Semite, that just means you have an irrational bias against them, and you don't talk about that with other countries in the region. No, but we have. How many segments have I do a segment, multiple segments a week on how fucked up Saudi Arabia is. I do multiple segments a week on how fucked up Iran is. I go after everybody who are doing fucked up things. So this is an attempt to deflect. Nobody's ever made this point in the service of, no, I'm seriously asking if you talk about the other countries because, I care about the human rights abuses in Israel and the other countries. They say this to say, pay no attention to Israel's abuses, only focus on the other countries. So they're calling out hypocrisy when in reality they're the hypocrites. And across the board, every time somebody's called me out on this, you dig deeper for them, and they don't want to criticize the occupation and the apartheid state, but they do want to criticize the other states. So you're guilty of what you're accusing us of being guilty of. Because what do? I have called for sanctions. I just called this fucking week for sanctions on Saudi Arabia. Yes, I would do sanctions. Of course I'd do sanctions. They say all atheists are terrorists. You think I want to be buddy-buddy with that nation? I'm a fucking atheist. Do I want to be considered a terrorist? No. They're out-and-out bigots. Yes, I want to crack down on them and do sanctions on them and untie our relationship with them and stop the fucking beheading of people for drug smuggling and sorcery and apostasy. I want to get them off the fucking human rights panel at the UN. Yes, I want to go after all these different countries and when appropriate do sanctions, when appropriate take the proper steps to try to improve the situation without doing full-scale invasions. but that includes Israel. How dare I? Yeah, and what's Hillary Clinton's trick on this? Oh, you support BDS? Well, I mean, that's pretty anti-Semitic, isn't it? Hey, look, don't take my word for it. We've done segments on it. You could watch her speech given to a Jewish group where she says exactly that. Oh, man, this is troublesome. This is troubling. Look at these kids trying to boycott Israel. They're obviously doing that because they're against the democratic values of Israel and how enlightened they are. Yeah, that's not a total and utter straw man. The people who are doing that, of course they support the democratic angle. Of course they support the better gay rights situation in Israel than in other places in the region. They're against the occupation and the fucking apartheid. But no, you bring that up. Oh, why are you singling them out? And again, they're deflecting as they accuse you of deflecting and only focusing on Israel. I want to focus on all the human rights abuses and fix it. They want to deflect from Israel and only focus on Saudi's abuses or Iran's abuses or other countries' abuses. So, guys, that's not what I'm trying to get through these people is that's not an argument. Like, you're not making a counter-argument when you say, well, okay, so Israel is violating international law, and they're doing illegal settlements, and it's an occupation, and it's apartheid. Okay, they're violating international law. Okay. But so are the other people. That's not an argument. That's not a fucking argument. I remember when Netanyahu was doing his bomb orgy in Gaza recently, which killed 80% civilians, one of the arguments that apologists for Netanyahu were making is, people are talking about this, the killing of civilians in Gaza, when ISIS exists, as if that's an argument. Hello, ISIS exists. They're worse. So talk about that. No, we could talk about both. And when you make that point in the context of a debate about an 80% civilian death rate as women and children are being slaughtered in Gaza, you look ridiculous and you look pathetic. And you look like you're trying to cover up, and that's not okay. Okay. Jesus, I'm not going to get to all these stories. God damn it, man. I'm going to save one of the Jill Stein ones for next week because I've done plenty Jill Stein stories today. Let me go to World Rohingya Day. This is pretty important. Actually, you know what? Yes, I'm going to do this one and try to squeeze in the other one too. I'm doing two more, goddammit. I said I'm fucking doing two more. Get off my back. Today is World Rohingya Day. It's a day to raise awareness about a very serious issue currently ongoing in Myanmar that very few people are aware of. So Myanmar, for those of you who don't know, is a majority Buddhist country, and they have a tiny Muslim minority. It's about 4% of the population or so. And from here, I'm going to let BBC take over and explain what their conditions are like.
Conflict and persecution scar Myanmar's moves towards democracy. To reach Chen Yipin, it's a two-hour journey by boat. The camp is home to 4,000 Rohingya Muslims who fled Buddhist attacks 3 years ago. On our way, we pass a man tending the grave of his two-month-old baby boy. 7 children have died here in the last month. None of them saw a doctor. This is why 2 months ago Buddhist mobs violently attacked international aid agencies in the state capital, Sitwe. Offices were ransacked and those providing health care to the Rohingya forced to leave. That means there are now tens of thousands of Muslims like Arabana without access to medical help. She's in so much pain, she can no longer walk. I want to be treated, she says, but I'm scared if I'm taken to hospital, the Buddhists will attack me. Across camp, we hear similar stories. There have been only 3 visits from Burmese government doctors since the aid agencies left, and no one trusts Buddhists to transfer them safely to hospital. What's happening here isn't being dictated by the central Burmese government, but by the local Rakhine Buddhist community. It's them who are stopping these Muslim Rohingya leaving from the camps, and it's them who are stopping aid agencies bringing healthcare in. In the past, the Burmese government would have simply acted decisively and forced their will on the people. Now, they say they're powerless to act. The Rakhine Buddhists are one of many Burmese minorities worried about their place in a country emerging from decades of military rule. At this village, the fishermen tell me that they should be receiving aid, not the Rohingya, who they say have come here illegally from Bangladesh. Back in a Rohingya camp near Sitwe, there's no one with medical training, but if you're desperate and you've got money, you visit this little shack. One of today's patients is a painfully thin, two-month-old baby boy called Mama Rohin. He's given rehydration fluids, but his needs are clearly much greater. We suffer and we die. That is our fate, his mum tells me. There are those who are calling what's happening here a slow-burning genocide, others ethnic cleansing. Whatever words you choose, this is a human tragedy. People trapped in camps, dying, and denied the most basic of rights.
So Amnesty International explains further here, quote, they are effectively denied citizenship under national law. Waves of violence against the Rohingya, mostly recently erupting in 2012, have forced tens of thousands into overcrowded camps where they live in desperate conditions. Some people said that they had been abducted by traffickers in Myanmar or Bangladesh, whereas others have been promised a safe passage to Malaysia for a nominal fee, a tactic commonly used by traffickers looking to coerce people into forced labor. So you have people fleeing, over 1,000 people have died on boats trying to get somewhere else so they can be safe and not have such a horrible life. There was a story not that long ago of a boat of Rohingya Muslims who hadn't eaten in like a week, and they were saved at the last minute. So again, many have died at sea, others, you know, coerced and brought into slavery. And it's just a horrible situation, man. It's a horrible situation. And, you know, they explained in great detail there in that BBC News report. So what's the solution? It's always hard in these situations to come up with a good solution, but I mean, UN pressure is pretty important, and trying to get aid groups in there by any means necessary, that seems like an absolute must-do. And then also perhaps targeted sanctions on Myanmar to make them do the right thing. But what we're dealing with here is a deep, deep issue of tribalism and bigotry and xenophobia and fundamentalism among some Buddhists there. So it's a terrible situation, and hopefully it gets taken care of and it gets fixed, although it's been going on for years already, so I don't know how hopeful that is. But World Rohingya Day gives us an opportunity to raise awareness about this and also flip the stereotypes on their head, too. I mean, there's no doubt, and I'm not saying this isn't true. Of course it's true. There's a lot of fundamentalist Islam-related terror attacks around the world. There's no denying that. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, you go down the list. Al-Shabaab. Nobody's denying any of that. And it's terrible. This is an instance where it's kind of a reality check in the sense that whoever thinks it's always the Muslims, they're all bad. But look at what's happening here. Here you have this poor Rohingya Muslim population who are clearly, overwhelmingly the victims, and you have Buddhist fundamentalists who are committing the atrocities. And again, that's another stereotype flipped on its head, because typically when you talk about religious violence, Buddhism ranks low on that, because statistically it is pretty low. So, but this shows you that the world is not black and white, man. It's shades of gray all over the place, and nobody's exempt from tribalism and bigotry and xenophobia, and we should oppose it wherever we find it. All right, I'm out of time, guys, but I'm going to squeeze in one more, so you guys can hang around and listen if you want, or you could catch it on YouTube. But let's do it. Here we go. I'm going to talk about this Salafi preacher. We have some incredible video here of a Salafi preacher explaining to fellow fundamentalist Muslims which emojis they're allowed to use. Check it out.
Emoticons. The face with the halo. When someone wants to share their innocence, or I'm a good boy, they send that, you know, that smiley face, the yellow face, with the halo. No. Because that halo represents, in Christianity, an angelic type of character. It's supposed to be for the angels, meaning it's the concept of I am good as an angel. Now, in Islam, do we believe angels in Islam are like the angels in Christianity that we've seen in their idols and statues? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So you cannot be sending the one with the halo, let alone anyone with the devil. There are many ones that are devilish, the red devil and stuff like that. We don't know what Shaitan and Iblis look like. Therefore, we're not allowed to draw him. Some people make videos or, you know, the different things trying to symbolize materialize the appearance of Iblis. We don't have the right in Islam to do this. We don't know what he looks like. It's from the knowledge of the unseen. So these emoticons that are devilish in their nature are not allowed, even if you're trying to say you're being a bad boy or a bad girl. This one, many people send it as a prayer. And this is, again, used amongst Buddhists and among Christians. Christians usually kneel on their knees and they make this particular form to supplicate, to ask God. In Islam, how do you make dua? You have your hands facing a sama like this, you know, and you raise it. We've never made dua like this. Maybe they do it in karate or something also. So this particular emoticon is not allowed because it resembles, and if you look at it, don't believe me, Google these things. These are among the things which is halal to Google. Google, go look it up and find out the explanation, which I did on your behalf. I did. And this is a religious symbol. It is a religious symbol. The same with this one. Saw that one coming. You know this one? This is also a symbol of Iblis. These are the two horns of Shaitan. And this is one of the hand symbols on WhatsApp.
We found the Pat Robertson of the Muslim world. This guy had a TV show. Can you imagine if you kept the words exactly the same and just let Pat Robertson speak them and replace, you know, all the references to Islam with Christianity? Oh, my God. Fucking hilarious. Oh, that's the saddest thing I've ever seen, but you can't turn away. It's like watching a fucking train wreck. He's lecturing what emojis you are and aren't allowed to use because of religion. Okay. The fact that you think God cares about what emoji you use shows narcissism on a level I've never seen before. Because think about what's happening in the world. Some people have cancer, there's natural disasters, look at Louisiana, the flooding is the worst since Hurricane Katrina, there's people are dying in over-the-top heat waves in the Middle East where temperatures are like 129 degrees. There's unbelievable amounts of death and destruction in the world. Look at what's happening in Syria. So many innocent people are being killed. This idiot is saying, you know, God, he doesn't want you to press that wrong smiley face in your fucking phone because he'll get super mad over that, man. He'll get super angry over that. Doesn't God have more important shit to be doing? Like fixing leukemia, maybe? That crazy idea? What a sad, narcissistic world this is where this guy's like, no, God cares about what buttons you press on your phone. But he's not going to help the people who are currently dying and in excruciating pain. And also, the hypocrisy of a fundamentalist Muslim following in an archaic desert religion, lecturing about how you can effectively and correctly, in accordance with religion, use your modern technology like your phone. Oh, I can't get over that hypocrisy. God, that makes me hate him so much. Like, that's so ridiculous. You're fucking, like, you're all the benefits of modern secular liberalism and science and Western society. You're like, I'm going to use all those things. But believe you me, I'm going to make this shit halal, son. So, no emojis! No emojis that fucking, that Allah would not like. And then the other takeaway from this is, dude, you think he doesn't really believe? Of course he believes. He believes enough to make an ass of himself and embarrass himself in front of the world with this fucking video where he's like, I think God cares about what emoji you use. And what a sad life that is. Seriously, think about that. On some level, I feel bad for guys like this because that's how you live your life. You walk around and you're like, oh God. Oh God, I hope God approves of the fucking fabric in the pants that I'm wearing today. I have a mix of fabrics and maybe that's a no-no. That's not okay. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I ate the wrong thing. I think there was bacon in the salad. God might kill me now and fucking send me to hell. What a sad life. Dude, it ain't true. Get over yourself and get over it. You're one person born into a religion, and over 4,000 religions exist on the planet right now. Are you really that special? No, no, no. My parents nailed it, and I'm nailing it. And I know exactly what God wants. God wants me to not use this emoji and that emoji and that emoji. This is the ramblings of a silly person disconnected from reality. You're not smart. You're not nailing it. This isn't on point. This is profoundly and immensely embarrassing. And this kind of fundamentalism is going to go away over time. Because anybody who knows how to Google can look at what you're saying and go, you know what? I think he's full of shit. Let's fact check him. In fact, everybody should, if you're a religious person, just Google contradictions in whatever fucking holy book you have and have fun, you know, turning away from your religion, because that's all it fucking takes. So use your mind. You're not that special. You weren't born into the one right religion when there's over 4,000 religions on the planet. Use reason and logic, and you can live a better life and be happier if you move away from old-school draconian beliefs written by morons in the desert when that stuff is not true. Okay. All right, guys. I love you. We'll see you on Monday. Mwah. Peace. Take care, y'all.